Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
2 weeks after the earthquake in Haiti, medical attention has shifted from emergency trauma care to rebuilding the medical infrastructure.
Today we saw nearly 300 patients, and very few of them actually had earthquake-related events. So what we're seeing now is that the patient population has shifted to the normal daily activities.
But normal activities at a hospital require beds and buildings, good record-keeping, post-op wards, and lots of nurses. And there's the next challenge. How do you treat Haitians that don't need the ER? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, January 26th, and The Takeaway is, how do you rebuild something that may not have existed in the first place in Haiti?
And they're going to need a lot of long-term care as a result
Absolutely.
Of this earthquake. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. We begin in Washington. President Obama speaking on the political minefield ahead of him.
I'd rather be a really good one-term president than a mediocre two-term president.
Well, he will make his case in his first State of the Union address, the president telling ABC News.
We've been so focused on just getting things done that I think that we stopped giving voice to the frustrations that people have about the process here in Washington.
To remedy that, he offered a package to help middle-class families yesterday. Today, we're learning the president will ask Congress to freeze spending for some domestic programs, as well as call for tighter rules on Wall Street and lift the ban on gays in the military.
As the aid continues to pour into Haiti, one resource desperately needed is nurses. Joining us now is Jeanette Sangos, a nurse practitioner. Good morning. You went to Haiti to offer your services as a nurse. Were there enough nurses when you were there?
No, there were not enough nurses. In fact, when we got there, they could not even continue doing surgery at night because there were not enough nurses to take care of the patients. And also, the night before, the patient were in the post-op, spend the whole night without anybody caring for them. There were no nurses at all.
We're going to be talking about that shortage and the implications of it in just a minute with Jeanette Sangos. Stay with us for them.
A parliamentary commission in France has recommended that Muslim women should not be allowed to wear face covering veils when using public services, including hospitals, schools, and public transportation. Earlier, we spoke to the BBC's Hugh Schofield in Paris, who told us the measure is controversial, but perhaps not in the way you think.
It is controversial. Controversial in the sense that many people think that this is not enough. There's probably a majority of people who are saying in France they do want a complete ban on the full veil, the sort of wraparound eye face covering veil.
There are an estimated 5 million Muslims in very secular France.
Here at home, welfare rolls rose last year for the first time in 15 years, but the 5% increase was dwarfed by spikes in the number of people receiving food stamps and unemployment insurance. Nearly one in five Americans said they didn't have the money to buy the food they needed at some point last year. The national survey also found more than 38 million Americans, that's one out of every eight, now receive food stamps. That's a record high. And a big upset this morning at the Australian Open. Defending champ Rafael Nadal is out in the quarterfinals after retiring because of a knee injury. We'll talk about that more later today. Futures are mixed in the markets. The Dow will get underway at 10,196. The S&P opens at 1,096 and the NASDAQ at 2210. Coming up this hour, we'll talk with presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin to talk about how President Obama is doing so far. That's later this hour.
She writes very long books, Doris Kearns Goodwin does, but can you give us a State of the Union in few words, say 6 words?
Ryan from Boston, 6 words on the State of the Union. Everybody knows somebody out of work.
Be creative, won't you? Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE or post it to our website, thetakeaway.org. I love Doris Kearns Goodwin's long books. Long is good.
Yeah, actually, they really are. Yes, you can dig into them with a cup of tea.
Coming up, more about Haiti and the medical needs in that earthquake-ravaged country.
Since the earthquake devastated much of the Haitian capital 2 weeks ago, the outpouring of support has been massive, and that includes support from the medical community. Doctors from around the world have flown into Haiti, and now there may actually be too many doctors there and not enough nurses or supplies.
There's an incredible amount of work that needs to be done, not just the medical care, but essentially building a hospital. So ranging from providing shelter and tents to getting food in, working on sanitation, communications, coordinating surgeries, getting supplies. We're building a medical institution for these people.
That was Dr. Paul Auerbach. He's a professor of surgery in the Division of Emergency Medicine at Stanford University. He spoke with our producer from Port-au-Prince yesterday. He's talking about the inherent problems involved in completely rebuilding a medical infrastructure. And we're joined again by Jeanette Sangal. She's a Haitian-American nurse practitioner who returned from Haiti on Friday. Also with us is Marianne McCune, reporter with WNYC Radio, who's been talking to medical professionals about the situation in Haiti. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Jeanette, when you were there, what kind of hours were you working? How many patients did you tend to each day?
I really was working about between 16 and 18 hours, really, and sleeping about 2-3 hours, really. And the amount of patients that we were taking care of, I will say on our ward, really, we had about 70 patients, who I will say about 70 patients, it may be more, and we were really taking care of everything from OBGYN to post-op to any emergency that comes in. It was really everything.
You know, Marianne, she's talking about a shortage. She was talking about a shortage of nurses earlier, but there's a number of problems in terms of rebuilding and in some times completely building the medical infrastructure in Haiti. Here's one of the doctors you interviewed at the Kingsbrook Jewish Medical Center in Brooklyn.
We now have pallets about 8 foot high of gauze pads and 8 foot high of masks and 8 foot high of gloves. We have small warehouse full of all kinds of blood pressure medications. We have sterile surgical trays, sanitizers to clean those trays. We have antiseptics for the patients. We have antibiotics for the patients. And we can't get down there.
Is that a common complaint, that there are supplies available that they can't get them into Haiti?
Supplies and people. That was Dr. William Lois, and he was among a group of doctors who were trying desperately to get down to Haiti, trying to get on a military flight or some flight, and they ended up giving up and going through the Dominican Republic. But so single-minded about getting there that they're, on their BlackBerries nonstop. And one of the reasons they felt it was so important that they get there is they speak Creole. They have experience. They're part of two overlapping groups that both have experience, years of experience working in Haiti. So they have the language there. They felt that they could do a great job. They know the General Hospital, which is where they ended up going to work. And
were they sending nurses? Or just
they
doctors?
Were sending a group of all kinds of doctors.
Everything.
And that really, one of them just returned, and I spoke to him recently, and he said that was one of the really important things. And Jeanette Sangos was with a previous group who went down.
Jeanette, what was the medical infrastructure like in Haiti before? People say where they're starting from scratch. Are they rebuilding an infrastructure that was there, or are they actually just creating something out of nothing?
I will say maybe there was a little something there, but not good enough to really receive this massive amount of traumatized patients. And that's what it was before. To start with, we didn't have almost really not much, nothing, I will say that. And it's like in the middle of a chaos, trying to construct really something so we can give as much care as possible to these patients.
Go ahead, Mary.
One of the things that Dr. Michel Charles, the doctor who just came back with that same group that Jeanette was with, he said, it's not necessarily the challenge of treating the patient or doing the right surgery. It's they got to the general hospital. They had to go with an engineer to figure out which buildings were okay to work in.
Wow.
And they made all these different units in those buildings, an ER, a pre-op, and a post-op. And he talked about one of the biggest challenges for him logistically and emotionally was that the first day they set up all these they moved all these patients inside, and then that night there was an earthquake. The big aftershock, and he arrived the next morning, and we have some tape of what happened.
So when we get there, we found everybody outside. because they have to move them because they didn't want to stay. You want to bring them up, they don't want to go back. That was really, really bad. We didn't know what to do. I didn't know. I didn't have a plan B. I didn't have that plan B. We didn't expect that. So you have to really see what I'm going to do.
Jeanette, we also heard reports coming out of Haiti that there's so many different independent teams working that sometimes somebody's dressings will be removed 5 times an hour because different teams of doctors will come through checking on the same patients. It sounds like there's a real lack of organization there.
Yes, I will say that. I definitely agree with that. In fact, myself, I must say on my last day in Haiti, I was able to really make some progress when it comes to that. In fact, my best day working, really, because I was able to establish chart for the patient, and establish what medication they are supposed to be, they are on, and so this way, and give report, really, to the other team coming in, so they knew exactly what to do. That part, we established that progress. And also, I know the physician coming now that went on Saturday, who took after us, really, Dr. August had said to stayed in Haiti to give them a report of what was going on, all the challenges that we had to deal with. So I really hope at that point now that things are in place. But we had that problem. There was not that coordination, really.
Okay, that's Jeanette Sangal. She's a nurse practitioner. She just returned from a trip to Haiti on Friday, and Marianne McCune is a reporter with WNYC Radio. And the big question here also is what happens in a few weeks when all these volunteers go home. You can read a dispatch from an intern who's gone to Haiti to volunteer at a hospital there at thetakeaway.org.
Keep the conversation going with your thoughts. Send them to us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Let's check in and now on the headlines at 15 minutes past the hour.
During tomorrow's State of the Union address, the president is expected now to ask Congress for a spending freeze on some domestic programs starting next year. The Pentagon, veterans programs, and Homeland Security would be exempt. Even as the White House is under pressure to cut the national debt, the president told ABC News he won't be raising taxes on the middle class.
I can guarantee that the worst thing we could do would be to raise taxes when the economy is still this weak.
We want to get your take, too. What's the state of our union? Are you in that middle class? Think you can do it in just 6 words? Here's Mark in Brooklyn's suggestion.
My 6 words are, I just started. Give me time.
Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our site, thetakeaway.org.
In other news, it looks like Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke will be confirmed for another term. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs says the confirmation should be smooth.
There's still a great amount of anxiety in our economy. But Chairman Bernanke helped the president and the economic team steer through some very turbulent times and rough waters.
Bernanke's current term ends on Sunday. Home prices rose nationally for the 6th straight month in November, with 14 of the 20 metro areas tracked showing improvements. Phoenix and San Francisco posted the highest month-to-month gains. New York and Chicago had the largest declines. Finally, young girls may learn to fear math from their teachers. A new study says young students model themselves after adults of the same sex, and female teachers who are anxious about their own math skills may be passing that fear on to their female students. That's a look at some of the stories you're watching this morning. Coming up, a blast in Baghdad has killed at least 18. We'll get the latest from the New York Times' John Leland.
Good morning, everyone. Grim headline out of Baghdad this morning from where John Leland, New York Times reporter, joins us. A car bomb killed at least 18 and injured dozens more in a strike against the Interior Ministry's offices in central Baghdad. Apparently, some hotels were also hit by apparently coordinated suicide attacks. John Leland, this main facility that was destroyed by the car bomb, what was it?
It was their forensics office, their forensics department. It was not the main office of the Ministry of the Interior, which I think would have been a totally devastating attack. And it was one of the more exposed public buildings here in Baghdad. It was right close to a main traffic rotary. So the bomb blew up just on the rotary.
So, and you can hear that John Leland is on a sketchy Skype connection there from Baghdad at the New York Times Bureau in Baghdad. So it's more a target of opportunity than a specific target that might suggest why these attacks took place. So what are the claims of responsibility at this point?
Well, the military here believes it's al-Qaeda. The government has said it is al-Qaeda acting in conjunction with former members of Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party. And most people seem to believe that we're seeing escalating violence in advance of the elections. Nouri al-Maliki, the prime minister here, has really made his reputation, staked his reputation on being able to create a secure environment. Attacks are believed to be an attempt to undermine that claim.
And finally, we were receiving reports yesterday of the execution of Ali Kamawi, so-called Chemical Ali, Saddam Hussein's most famous relative. Any chance this is related to that?
Certainly yesterday's bombings of three major hotels were not connected with that, because they were really sophisticated operations that would have taken weeks and possibly months of planning. Today's attack is likely not connected with it, but it is more possibly connected with it.
Finally, any change on the part of U.S. forces in Iraq as in terms of countermeasures protecting Baghdad?
The U.S. forces have largely moved out of the cities. They're not doing operations in the cities anymore unless asked by the Iraqi security forces. So their focus is mainly on electronic intelligence in different ways, and the Iraqis are doing the human intelligence. And on both sides, they're saying there's a better sharing of information now.
But certainly some level of insecurity there in Baghdad. John Leland is a New York Times reporter in Baghdad. Thanks so much.
Let's go to Australia now. In tennis, Rafael Nadal bowed out of the Australian Open after he suffered a knee injury during his quarterfinal game. We're joined now by John Wertheim, who stayed up. He's a senior writer at Sports Illustrated. He's in Melbourne covering the Open. John, what happened to Nadal today? Is this part of his tendonitis problem?
Well, we hope it's only that serious. It was really a sensational match with Andy Murray. It was really very high-quality tennis. Nadal's a defending champion. Murray's a top-five player. And then toward the end of the second set, the beginning of the third set, Nadal clearly did something to his knee. We're sort of still awaiting word. But, you know, here's a guy who really competes harder than anyone else. And for him to retire, for him to basically just sort of quit in the middle of the match and say, I'm not fit to continue, it must be pretty serious. And it was really an unfortunate way to end what had been, for two sets anyway, just a great tennis match.
He has had trouble with his knees, as we talked about earlier, with tendonitis, and some people say that's because of his playing style. Do you agree?
I do, and I'm not sure there's an alternative style. I mean, it's just sort of the way his game is built and his body is built. But no, it really has become quite a concern that he was, a year ago he won this tournament and really seemed to be, he was the number one ranked player and really seemed to be one of these guys that could challenge for the all-time great. And he's had these injuries since, and you wonder, given how physical his tennis is, and they play on these hard courts, and the game, the rackets have gotten lighter and the hitting's gotten harder, you really worry if he can sustain a decent career now.
Do you think this may be the end of his career? I mean, you're talking about whether or not he can sustain it. Can we expect to see him back?
Well, I think we'll see him back. I mean, he's still in his early 20s, and maybe there are adjustments he can make both to his game and to his playing schedule. But, I think we see this in other sports, too, where there's some of these athletes who just, they have a certain way they play. It's so physically taxing, and I think he'll be back. But I don't think now his trajectory is to go on to be one of the greatest ever. I just don't think, the game's gotten too physical, and I think, his body might just not be cut out for it.
But let's take apart the physical bit for a second. I mean, Nadal's physical is lower extremities, whereas someone like one of the other players, it's more the forehand, the actual strokes that where the strength comes.
Yeah, exactly. He also has sort of a big upper body, which I think taxes the lower body. But I think some of it, too, is just the style he plays, which is this grinding physical style. He runs after every ball. He's not light on his feet, as they say. And it's really a joy to watch. It's a great contrast to some of the other players. But, you know, I've likened it sort of to Earl Campbell, the old running back. Some
right.
guys sort of are fleet of foot and dance around the side, and others just sort of run up the gut. And I think, unfortunately for Nadal, it's just such a heavy game he plays, and his mentality is to go after every ball. It just doesn't lend itself to a long career, unfortunately.
So, John Wertheim, who's left in the Australian Open to watch for?
Well, there's still, I mean, the Justine Henin on the women's side is a big story, and, you know, we have Roger Federer, who's going for still another Grand Slam. I mean, there are plenty of storylines to follow, but again, it was such a nice match tonight. It was awfully disappointing to see it end the way it did.
Okay, John Wertheim is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated. He joined us from Melbourne,
and
Australia.
It's a great comparison to Earl Campbell, because in the end, even though he was a legend, his body gave out on him. It does on so many NFL players. So, coming up,
I can't think of anything more devastating to the public interest.
We're going to talk more about that Supreme Court decision on campaign finance rules and how foreign corporations might be able to influence American elections now. More in a few minutes. We're also heading to the State of the Union address tomorrow night. Thinking about it, what do you think President Obama might say?
This is Gary from Route 80. Why don't we borrow more money?
Six-word State of the Union address. You can do it. 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, we talk with a former commissioner of the Federal Election Commission about whether the Supreme Court has actually invited unbridled corporate influence in state, local, and federal elections in the United States. Right now, let's check in on top news stories at about 30 minutes after the hour. As James Carville famously told then-candidate Bill Clinton, it's the economy, stupid. And so one day before his first State of the Union address, President Obama is taking that to heart.
We're going to keep fighting to rebuild our economy so that hard work is once again rewarded, wages and incomes are once again rising, and the middle class is once again growing.
There's a package of middle-class family programs to help the middle class. And today we're learning the president is going to ask Congress to freeze spending for some domestic programs. Earlier in the program, we spoke to Jason Johnson, a political science professor in Northeast Ohio, who told us people in his state like what they're hearing about the spending freeze, but it's of little consolation to those without jobs.
The independents who are at home because they haven't found work, they don't care about a freeze in funding. They just want to find out when the jobs are going to be available, if they're going to lose their unemployment benefits. They want to find out if spending 24 hours a day, 7 days a week looking for a job is actually going to result in something effective.
So, State of the Union, six words or less.
This is Johnny from Michigan. In my state of the nation is quit fighting and get the job done.
Maybe we'll hear that tomorrow night. Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or thetakeaway.org. Back to the news.
This morning, a parliamentary commission in France recommended that Muslim women should not be allowed to wear face-covering veils in hospitals, schools, or while taking public transportation. Anyone who does would be refused residence cards and citizenship. There are an estimated 5 million Muslims in France. And new numbers out last hour show home prices rose nationally for the sixth straight month in November, with 14 of the 20 metro areas tracked showing improvements. Markets are open now. The Dow is down about 40 points. The S&P down 4 points. The NASDAQ is down about 9. Those are some of the news stories you're watching this morning.
So after the Supreme Court ruled last week that corporations have the same rights as individuals under the First Amendment, it seemed a little bit like the balance of powers was little grumpy. Listen to the president talking about the judiciary.
I can't think of anything more devastating to the public interest. The last thing we need to do is hand more influence to the lobbyists in Washington or more power to the special interests to tip the outcome of elections.
The president talking about the Supreme Court ruling on elections that will affect everyone in Congress. Yes, it's a landmark ruling with lots of implications. Joining us now is Scott Thomas, former FEC, Federal Election Commission chairman, who served on the commission from 1986 to 2006. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, John.
So this is a fascinating case, and we could talk about it for a couple of hours here, but let's focus in on the issue of corporations and their giving. Does this decision and again, it's your opinion, but still, does this decision require the FEC to look more closely at corporations and who's giving to elections, or maybe allows them to not pay so much attention anymore?
Well, I'm guessing that in some respects it will require more work by the FEC, because although the decision in theory has left intact the contribution prohibition that's been in federal law, the question will move to, okay, so what is a contribution, and how is a contribution really different from an independent expenditure, which the court freed corporations to make? And the toughest area will really relate to this concept of what is a coordinated communication. And for years, a coordinated communication is treated as a contribution. So that's where the real battle will lie, and lots of folks will be filing complaints saying, well, actually, there was some coordination. The corporate officials were coordinating with a candidate who was the subject of the ad. So
right, so too much.
Let
me just back up for a second. Too much contact with the actual candidate, and it becomes a coordinated direct contribution. But if there's no contact with the candidate, in a sense, there's really no limit to what the corporation can do to fund anything but the direct campaign expenditures of the individual candidate, right?
That's right. What's really been freed up is the so-called independent or uncoordinated ads.
All right. Now, I can certainly look in the mirror and tell the difference between John Hockenberry, American citizen, and General Motors, U.S. Corporation, or Xerox, U.S. Corporation. I can vote. The corporations can't vote. I have an address here in Brooklyn, New York, in the United States. Corporations can have addresses all over the world. Can foreign corporations get involved in this?
Well, in theory, the foreign national prohibition was not before the court, and in theory, the court has not addressed that. And actually, there is a small passage in the opinion where they sort of point out that they're not interpreting that particular restriction. But you're right. There is just a huge potential for confusion, if you will, because there are so many foreign-owned or foreign-controlled corporations, and the measure of whether or not the foreign national prohibition is still good law is going to be very, very difficult.
But in theory, if I'm the CEO of I Hate America Forever, a company in Saudi Arabia, okay, that's on some side street, and I set up a Gosh We Love America subsidiary in Detroit, Michigan, all right, say. I can contribute to anyone, right?
Well, again, the contribution restriction is going to be in place, but for any corporation. But for independent expenditures, yes. I mean, there's going to be this potential for domestic subsidiaries of foreign-owned or controlled companies to use this new allowance that the Supreme Court has carved out. And the question will be, I suppose, for the FEC, what does it mean when the statute says, well, you can only let a domestic subsidiary get involved that way if it's principally operating in the United States.
Principally
what does that
operating,
mean?
Well,
that's where the battle line will be. It'll be a mess.
And the FEC is going to have to be looking at all that sort of paperwork. Here's a question from one of our listeners.
This is Al in Oklahoma City. If corporations have a right to contribute all the money they want to campaigns, particularly in the form of ads, then they should be held to citizenship regulations just like the rest of us, and they should have to declare a nation of citizenship and pay taxes to that nation.
Now, does something like this force corporations to act more like citizens in the sense that they have to declare, a vote? They do pay taxes already, but how does this change corporations at all?
Well, corporations, when they make a political expenditure, are supposed to track that and make sure that they don't declare that as a business expense deduction when they're calculating their income taxes. So in theory, when you make a political expenditure, you're going to have to pay taxes on the revenue that was used to do that. So that's going to be in place. And for nonprofits also, there are tax provisions that in theory cause them to, in essence, have to pay taxes when they incur those kinds of expenses. But it's very complicated to track, obviously.
Well, before we go, can you envision a campaign, a time when rhetoric like the aluminum industry supports this candidate and that will be part of the language of our politics?
Well, I suppose it depends on how lax the Federal Election Commission is. If the FEC is very, very weak in terms of trying to establish rules about how to define whether a domestic corporation really should be allowed to operate on its own as if it were not a foreign controlled company, then we've got a problem. If the FEC is tough, in theory, it won't be quite as bad, but it's still going to be very complicated.
Scott Thomas, former Federal Election Commission chairman, talking about last week's decision by the Supreme Court on campaign financing. Coming up, how's the president doing? We talk about the president's time in office so far with historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. That's later this hour. And what about you? What do you think the state of the union and the state of Obama's job performance so far are?
This is Glenn Maxwell in Detroit, and my take on the state of the union is Obama's change. Democrats didn't get it.
A progressive voice on the state of the union. Tell us your six-word take at 8778-MY-TAKE or post it at thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. The pregnancy rate among teenage girls in the United States has jumped for the first time in more than a decade. That's according to a report released today by the nation's leading reproductive health think tank, the Guttmacher Institute. The pregnancy rate among 15 to 19-year-olds increased 3% between 2005 and 2006. Bill Albert joins us now. He's the chief program officer at the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
Can you put this in perspective for this? How big a jump is 3%?
Well, given that it's the first increase in the teen pregnancy rate since 1990, I think it's quite startling. And, of course, this comes on the heel of what we already knew, which is 2 years of increases in the teen birth rate. Just to put it in perspective, the pregnancy rate usually comes out later than the teen birth rate, and we've now seen increases in both. So I really think, to me, the headline from this really sobering data is that one of the nation's real shining success stories of the past two decades may be in danger of unraveling.
And that would be the cutting in these numbers. Do we have any idea what's causing it?
Well, I think there are any number of reasons. We had a great formula that was working for us in this country. Again, we saw declines in teen pregnancy in all 50 states and among all racial ethnic groups, and in every year until this most recent data since 1990. And the magic combination was less sex and more contraception. More teens were delaying sexual activity, which is positive, and more sexually active teens who were using contraception more consistently and carefully. That seems to be reversing now, unfortunately.
Were you surprised by these numbers? Or did you expect it?
No, we sort of expected it because, again, we had seen an increase in the teen birth rate. And as a general matter, the pregnancy rate follows the birth rate. So we weren't shocked. But I have to say that it is, even so, it's quite alarming. And we hope, to the extent that there's a silver lining here, that this does serve as sort of a wake-up call to policymakers and practitioners and parents that, you know, what goes down can go back up again, and this does deserve some real attention.
Let's take it one step further in terms of causal relationships. You say that there, you know, we're really good at reducing the amount of sex, and we're really good at upping the use of contraception. What's causing those things to change?
Well, that's really the $100,000 question here. We can only speculate, and here are some things that we hear from folks who work with teenagers on the front lines. One thing they tend to cite is that there is less concern among this generation of young people than in previous generations about STDs in general and HIV in particular. And, of course, that might have an effect on what teens are doing sexually. It's also the case that a lot of the pregnancies occur among 18 and 19-year-olds, and we just haven't done a very good job, in my view, in this country in trying to reach that age group, the older teens. I think it's also true that many young people simply are not or have not gotten enough information about contraception over the past 5-10 years.
Okay, and perhaps affected by the downturn in the economy?
Well, you know, traditionally, if you look at fertility rates as a general matter, they don't track so closely to economic rates, oddly enough. And particularly among teens, I think it's probably not a close relationship.
Great. Thanks. Bill Albert is the chief program officer at the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy. He's talking about a new report out today that shows that the pregnancy rate among 15 to 19-year-olds increased by 3% between 2005 and 2006. It's the first increase in more than a decade.
Coming up, I'm John Huckenberry here with Celeste Headlee. We talk with presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin about the State of the Union. But right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. The president lays out his agenda tomorrow night in his first State of the Union address, expecting to outline plans including tighter rules for Wall Street, job creation, lifting the ban on gays in the military. We'll get more on that in just a few minutes. We want your take as well. What is the state of our union, and can you say it all in just six words?
Hi, this is Ben from Clifton, New Jersey. My six-word state of the union is, on second thought, maybe we can't.
This is Carol from Salt Lake City. My six words would be, how did we get here? Complacency.
I'm Jeff from Lansing, Michigan. My six words are, save our ship, bring jobs home.
Tell us your take at 877-8MYTAKE or post it to our site, thetakeaway.org. In Haiti, President René Préval made an urgent appeal yesterday for 200,000 more tents to provide shelter for those left homeless by the earthquake. In solidarity with the victims, he's going to move into a tent on the lawn of the collapsed National Palace in Port-au-Prince.
This morning in Afghanistan, NATO says a blast hit near a U.S. military base in the capital. At least six civilians were wounded. NATO says there have been no reported casualties. Back at home, the Transportation Department has announced an immediate ban on text messaging by truck and bus drivers on the road. And finally, one down, more than 309 million to go. The U.S. Census began the 2010 count of the country's residents in an Arctic village yesterday. The first person tallied was Clifton Jackson, the oldest resident in an Alaskan Inuit community. Those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
The state of the union.
The state of our union.
State of the union.
My fellow Americans, the state of our union is
going to be fine.
Very, very public.
A complete disaster.
A little more honest.
Business as usual.
Part of our coverage of the State of the Union week, the president addressing the nation on Wednesday night. Doris Kearns Goodwin, presidential historian and author of the book Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln, along with many other books, joins us from her home. Good morning, Doris.
Good morning, John. I'm glad to be with you.
It's great to talk to you again. First of all, how does this shape up historically as a moment? It seems to me just a few weeks ago, Barack Obama had enormous momentum. He was working with the Congress. He bet on the 60-vote majority. It led him down there in Massachusetts. Can you recall a reversal, and it seems to be a reversal, like this in the past?
Well, not in such a period of time, you know, just like weeks before the State of the Union. Although when you think about some of the other dramatic moments of difficulty for presidents, this one is much less difficult than Clinton having to go to the State of the Union, you know, almost days after he announced, "I did not have sex with that woman,"
yeah,
or having to stand up there when the impeachment trial was already underway. So, I mean, I think he still got a chance to shift the tone. And in some ways, you know, Churchill once said after he lost the election in 1945 that his wife had said to him, "Don't worry, it's a blessing in disguise." And he said, "Well, if so, the disguise is pretty well disguised."
That's great.
Maybe this Massachusetts thing will have mobilized him to really focus on whose side he's on and let the country get much simpler understanding of what he stands for.
In a sense, Doris Kearns Goodwin, the president bet on him being able to work with Congress, a bet that Lyndon Johnson made when he passed the civil rights legislation. But is the Congress of Barack Obama the same as the Congress of Lyndon Johnson, either structurally, or certainly the personnel have changed?
That's a really good question, John, because I think it's true that he came in with two promises. One, that he was going to change the tone of the way the Congress and Washington worked, in other words, be a more bipartisan leader. And two, he had some real substantive goals that he wanted to achieve in health care, financial reform, and job creation. And I think what the experience of the year has shown was that it wasn't able to produce the bipartisan creation. And I'm not sure that that was his fault. He certainly did go after it in those first couple months as hard as he could have. Then the time comes, you decide, if I can't get it, then I still have to go forward in a different way. And the way Lyndon Johnson finally got the Civil Rights Act through was he let a filibuster go on for 57 or 67 days before they were finally able to get cloture. You know, and it may be that that's the kind of toughness that you have to bring to bear.
Wow.
Give up on the idea that you're going to get these guys to go along, but say this is important for the country. Let everybody see those guys talking and reading phone books and not going to the bathroom in order to prevent financial reform, for example. I don't think you should do it on health care. There's not enough agreement on it. But if there's real agreement on financial reform, you present that in the State of the Union, and then you say, okay, we're going to fight for it. You filibuster, let the country see that you're not really for changing Wall Street.
And that was even in the pre-C-SPAN era. And we should remind people that Lyndon Johnson had a generation of political favors grown up from his time in the Congress as a congressman and a senator. Barack Obama wasn't even through his first term there in the Senate. But let's talk tone for a second. Doris, listen to these three statements from Barack Obama, and let's talk for a moment. First, here's a kind of a scary remark from the president.
I'd rather be a really good one-term president than a mediocre two-term president.
And here's Barack Obama being very natural with Diane Sawyer on ABC News.
When your poll numbers drop, you're an idiot. When your poll numbers are high, you're a genius. If my poll numbers are low, then I'm cool and cerebral and cold and detached.
He also described himself as getting a bit gray in his first year. And finally, here's something that's self-deprecating, self-critical.
We've been so focused on just getting things done that I think that we stopped giving voice to the frustrations that people have about the process here in Washington.
Has Barack Obama found a tone, or does he feel a little all over the map? And I picked those clips deliberately. Doris Kearns Goodwin?
Yeah, I think this address, more than many others, tone will matter. And I think there has to be some sense that the people feel he's on their side against the special interests. I mean, the problem in going for so long for health care and the way it finally got done, to the extent that the bills were produced by each house, was it did seem like a triumph of a lot of little special interests, even though the ultimate result is probably a good thing. So I think the key for him now, every president has to make the general people feel, I'm on your side. It doesn't mean he has to scream and yell about Wall Street, although he has to show strength on it. But it means that he has to make people remember the person who ran that won that election in 2008, where people felt, he'll be fighting for me. I think there has to be a fighting tone. I mean, usually State of the Unions are judged not so much by the performance, even though that's what we'll do the day after, or the popularity of the words, but by whether the president is able to mobilize Congress, the interest groups, and the people to fight for his goals.
Well, that takes us right into history. And resolve a mystery for me. You know, we are always told that in the first off-year election, the president loses seats in Congress. But Franklin Roosevelt, famously, in his off-year election, his first one, gained seats. And his whole approach in talking to the American people was to actually prosecute the financial leaders of the previous administration, to go after the banks, to take a hyper-populist view. Is that even open to Barack Obama?
I don't know. I mean, it took a while even for Franklin Roosevelt to be willing to take that view, because at first he too tried, despite the 100 days, which we remember, where both sides were willing to do something because the Depression was so deep. He tried in the first couple years to have business go along with him. Some of his early programs had business support, but then they didn't follow through. Finally, they started calling him a traitor to his class, and then finally he gets up and he says, I welcome their hatred.
Right.
I mean, it's hard to imagine Obama saying that. You have to have that willingness inside, but I think he could say, if he talks about financial reform and the need to not allow the banks to do, not just punish them, and that doesn't make sense, but not allow them to do what they did to get us into this again, he's got to show that kind of willingness to say, okay, they're against me, that's fine, I'm on your side.
I'm a big fan of your books. They are big, your books. Lots of words in them.
Big sometimes.
You want to take a shot at our 6 words or less State of the Union?
Oh, God, no.
Pretty good. Pretty good. Three words, Doris.
Three words.
Three words.
Good.
Oh, God, no. Doris Kearns Goodwin, presidential historian, author of Team of Rivals, a long book, Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln. And that's good. That's good. Her books are long and
they're
fantastic. Tomorrow, as part of our State of the Union series, we're going to talk with Republican Governor Tim Pawlenty of Minnesota.
Let's just turn this over to our listeners now. How do you think President Obama is doing so far? 877-8-MY-TAKE or post to our website at thetakeaway.org. That's also where you can go to give us your State of the Union. And can you describe it in 6 words or less?
Hi, this is Gretchen in Boston with my State of the Union. Extraordinary privilege and poverty must work harder.
Hi, this is Peter Lex in Providence, and my 6-word takeaway is, yes, we still can.
My name is Dan Gregory, and I'm calling from Lubbock, Texas. My 6 words are, most people reject your socialist policies.
And on our website, Paul writes, Demo Tragics and Republic Can'ts. Wah, wah, wah. Rick writes, Took over Titanic, turned it around. Give us your take. 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our site, thetakeaway.org. While you're there, we have continuing coverage of Haiti with a dispatch from Takeaway intern Eleanor Miller. She went to Haiti to volunteer at a hospital, and you can read her story at thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.